Okay, Mr. Clayton, if you would, let's talk about your life at the base camp. Tell me what that was like. We looked at some pictures when you brought it in. You showed me where you live, what your barracks are like. Describe where you live.
Okay, we lived in, it was a Butler building, which is a steel building. And then the back half of it, the south half of it, was a warehouse for storage for the Vietnamese. And the north half, they put kind of wooden dividers and made cubicles for the advisors to sleep in. And you had a room, there was four of us, two of us to a room. It was a bunk bed type deal. And the whole room was for each person. Each person had a little refrigerator deal with a little freezer thing in it. The whole room was probably 14, 16 feet long, each cube, 14 foot. It may have been 14 foot, maybe a little less than that, by about 8 feet.
Okay.
8 by 14, 8 by 10, 8 by 12, something like that. In this, you could hang your, have your flak jacket, bulletproof vest, your rifle, had places to hang up different things, and had a locker to put your uniforms in, which we had to have 100-watt light bulbs and in the clothes locker, because it was during the wet season, it was so damp and everything would mildew overnight.
You would just stay wet all the time.
Just mildew. Just overnight. And so you had a light bulb in your closet or in your locker. Like I say, the bunk beds had the mosquito netting. The mosquitoes were, they would put ours to shame for size. And there were a lot of them. Then we had a common area, probably about as big as this room, whatever the dimensions of it are, probably 20 by 30 at the biggest. We used it for a dining hall, and then had a little room off to the side of it for the kitchen. Had a propane stove, the refrigerator, a deep freeze, and this, that, and the other.
Who would do your cooking for you?
Well, we didn't have a cook there for quite a while, so those who could cook and who weren't on the river all day, essentially the radio operators, because they worked in shifts in the radio shack, they were the cooks.
Okay.
And they might be an engineman or a gunner's mate, and no telling who would do the cooking. Each one had their specialty. And we would go like that. During the good weather, we'd have a, we had a pretty nice barbecue grill that we wound up with. And we would do a lot of grilling. We'd get a lot of shrimp off the boats coming back in the river. Biggest shrimp you ever seen in your life. And we would have a fish fry and shrimp at least twice a week for supper, usually. We had our regular grocery supplies that we bought in the meantime, but it took about two months probably, before we were able to set this supply line up from the Army for our food. So we had sea rations that we used a lot. Then once we got that established, well, we did pretty good. And about 2 months before I came back to the States, they sent us a cook.
Okay. Vietnamese or American?
American Navy pay grade E6. He was E6 commissaryman, first class commissaryman. Really knew his stuff.
Mm-hmm.
He was a baker. He could do it all.
Hmm.
And so we ain't really good, last too much.
Mm-hmm.
Rest of the time, well, it was whatever we could fix up.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a fellow that was a EOD specialist. He was from Australia.
Mm-hmm.
He could do wonders with anything that sea rations made.
Okay.
He could really, he could make them look good and taste wonderful, whatever he did to them.
Would you take them out of their your packet? And
out of the can. And
he would
cook them up.
Hmm. Okay.
The powdered scrambled eggs, you'd swear them down. They was a real McCoy.
Huh.
He could just do anything with sea rations,
uh-huh.
and they were good when he got through with them. It was amazing.
Did you have any civilians, Vietnamese civilians, on base?
Just the dependents of the Vietnamese sailors,
okay,
as far as I know.
How much interaction did you have with them?
Hardly any, really. Most of the time, it would be pretty close to dark by the time I'd get back in on the river anyway.
Mm-hmm.
By the time I'd eaten and settled down, well, it was a couple hours of amusing myself. I played a little guitar, and I wound up with one over there, and letter writing, and card games, and this, that, and the other,
mm-hmm.
cleaning the place up where we were at,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
After taking care of all of that, because we had two cleaning girls that did a lot of it, a lot of cleaning, but we still went in behind them a lot of times. And then I'd be back in bed by 10:30 at night usually, unless on occasion I would have stand radio watch to fill in for somebody, or if we got short-handed, and then so I'd pull a 4-hour tour in Radio Shack every once in a while, then get about an hour of sleep, get up, go on the river, and after I ate something for breakfast.
Mm-hmm.
But it was pretty much of a routine. We had one little, real small building about the size of this room, that we actually made kind of like a military club.
Mm-hmm.
We had a bar set up. We had probably the only pool table north of Quang Tri. A lot of Army people used to come up there, and just for the heck of it, out of Quang Tri and Dong Hai, just to get away off the Army base.
Mm-hmm.
And for something different, they could, there for a while, they, those that knew how to surf would even get out there off the beach and surfboard.
Hmm.
I wouldn't have tried it, but some of them did.
Mm-hmm.
Because there were snakes in them rivers and everything else. Mm-hmm. No.
Did you see any interesting wildlife or snakes?
Snakes, like herds of them,
really?
For lack of a better word.
Yeah.
And the way in the river, kind of a red color.
Okay.
And I don't remember what kind they were.
Did anybody ever get bitten or any problems with them?
No, not that I know of.
Did you have any pets on base?
They had some dogs.
Uh-huh.
Funny thing, you never saw any young pups.
Really?
They were all old dogs.
Why is that?
You never saw puppies. Well, the Vietnamese always told me that they were pretty good for food.
Mm-hmm.
I never saw a cat the whole time I was there.
Hmm.
Never saw one.
Was there a reason for that did you ask?
I never did find out why that was.
Okay.
Because up in the jungle, check, they got tigers and everything else up in the high mountains.
Right,
you know?
Right.
But you never saw anything like a house cat or anything like that. Never saw one the whole time I was there.
So were you able to keep up with any news back home in the United States while you were there?
A little bit. We would get the Armed Forces newspaper.
Mm-hmm. Stars and Stripes?
Stars and Stripes. And, of course, all of us, we had had several radios that we could use. And I could listen to radio every once in a while. Most of it was Vietnamese stations, but sometimes I could pick up an American broadcast somewhere. And other than that, we had Armed Forces Television. And we did have a TV in certain hours of the day when we'd get news broadcast. And so we could, and of course, letters from home. My letters from home really didn't go into the news aspect of it that much. We just go into the family part and how are you doing or what are you doing, and I would try to tame it down as much as possible, especially for my, my mother and dad. And mother thought I worked in a ship store in, on the base, so I was there until I got back, and then I finally kind of slowly but surely broke it in to her. And dad knew pretty much what I was doing. I don't know whether he ever told her or not.
Were they worried about you?
I'm sure they were.
How often did you write each other?
I would write. Now, there's another funny thing. There for a while, I couldn't get my address straight, so I didn't get email for a couple of months after I got there. The Vietnam roster had me down by Saigon somewhere. And I was actually, what, 800 miles north. And another, they had me at a place called Cat Lo. Is that up by Saigon, maybe?
It's in the south, yes, sir.
Okay, they had me in a minesweeping of a river outfit in Camp Catalogue.
So all your mail went down there?
And then eventually wound up dead letter office, I guess. My first wife went to, because I kept writing, they kept getting my letters. I kept saying, I'm not getting any mail. So she went to the congressman, Mr. Mahon. And I guess he found a whole sack full of mail to me in the dead letter office in the post office somewhere. So eventually they got everything straightened out, because somehow or another it just, when it would get so far to Vietnam in country, then it would get diverted some to a place where I was not at.
That was tough for you, I'm sure, not to get mail for 2 months.
Well, I wondered what was going on, I was writing. I wrote a little bit most nights. It may be on the same letter. I made it a point to write my wife and my parents, my grandparents. I drop them a note, not quite as often as I should, but mother and dad about once every week or 2 weeks. And my wife, about every week, I send her something.
Were you ever able to make any of the Mars telephone calls?
Never was.
Where was your television located? Was it in your barracks there, or was it in the little club that you had?
It was in the dining area.
The dining area, the mess area.
That was all the one we had. Interesting thing about being lost. We had a, it was a E-4, third class petty officer, I think. I forget his designation, but his mother or grandmother or something, he received word through the Red Cross that some family member had deceased, and he was a young kid, really tore him up. He wanted to get emergency leave, go back to the States. So I piled him in a Jeep, and we drove to Quang Tree in a dirt road, and went to the Red Cross office on the Army base. And I went in and told him the story of the whole works and introduced myself, of course. And we were in there. I think Red Cross had a lot to do with finding me, too. Mm-hmm. I wasn't really missing. They just didn't know where I was at.
Right, right.
And it wasn't a missing in action sea story or nothing. It's the truth.
Missing in Vietnam.
In Vietnam. And so I got him set up for emergency leave, and this young fellow from Red Cross said, Sumner Clayton, why does that name sound familiar? And I said, well, I don't know, sir. I never have been in this office before or had anything to do with Red Cross. He said, just a minute. He got to digging back through some files or folders. Mm-hmm. He said, we've been looking for you for 2 months. So I said, well, who's looking for me? And he said, your wife and your father and mother. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, send them a telegram or something and tell them I'm okay and where I'm at. Mm-hmm. So he did, I guess.
Good.
But that was just pure accident that, right. That everything got found. And shortly after that, anyway, between that and I was told Mr. Mahon had handed it to on the mail. I finally started, I got a whole sack full of mail, and after that, everything was all right because another mix-up, we got our mail at an Army post office box mm-hmm. out of Quang Tri mm-hmm. at the Army Advisory Team 16 or something like that, I think mm-hmm. was the name of it. Mm-hmm. And they're the ones who got our mail. Mm-hmm. And we had to go down there, send somebody at Quang Tri every day, pick up mail messages. From the Army.
Mm-hmm. Was it a dangerous drive down from where you were down to Quang Tri?
No, not really.
No,
still pretty flat. Rice paddies. You had mm-hmm. people working out in rice paddies. You drove right through the center of a real small village. Mm-hmm. At, I don't know how many huts they had in that village, but there weren't very many.
So no incidents, no problems?
No incidents whatsoever.
Okay.
And when you get to Quang Tri, first thing you'd smell would be the open fish market, and then you'd go on into Quang Tri City, mm-hmm. an old dirt road, about 8 miles.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Did you ever see any drug use or excessive alcohol use while you were there?
Alcohol use, yes. Other drugs, no.
Okay.
The... Of course, sailors, they really like to drink sometimes. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry to say, the first senior advisor we had was in pretty bad shape.
I won't
give his name. He had been there too long, I think.
Really?
And he was Navy captain. Mm-hmm. And he... had an alcohol problem. I drank a little bit more than I should have
okay.
in the evenings sometimes. Mm-hmm. And as he did most of the other ones. Mm-hmm. I can't say that I didn't have too much to drink several times because I did, and mm-hmm. I shouldn't have, and I knew better, but I did anyway, and mm-hmm. luckily nothing happened.
Right.
Like I say, it just sometimes we do things that we shouldn't. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Did you find that you had enough supplies in camp that you could at least get them through your various means?
Well, we ran out of ammunition for M16s one time.
Did you really?
We were down to about 1,000 rounds. Couldn't get any. Hmm. Couldn't get them from the Army for some reason or another. Mm-hmm. Couldn't get them from the Navy. Mm-hmm. I had a team. We put together a team. They were good. Somehow or another, they confiscated 4 cases of M16 ammunition out of the armory on the South Vietnamese base we were at. And we could go to the army base in Dong Ha, mm-hmm. and we found out, because sometimes you'd have to go there for supplies or this, that, or the other. Mm-hmm. And we had this Vietnamese Jeep. Mm-hmm. Had 2 of those. Okay, we wound up somehow, I won't say how, with an American Marine Corps Jeep.
You won't say how, or you can't say how?
I won't say how.
Okay.
And the numbers were changed on it. It wound up with a new paint job, and we also had a kind of like a pickup bed trailer that we wound up with. And we would get in these, when we would go to the U.S. Army bases, we couldn't get on there in a Vietnamese Jeep.
Right.
We could get on those bases with this particular Jeep.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think it came from Da Nang somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, we could drive over there with an empty trailer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we needed sandbags one time. We needed to fill some sandbags.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't get any sandbags anywhere, and they had millions of them over there.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't get them because the Vietnamese have to provide.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to a signal supply place. I went to the Army engineer place first. He said, yeah, he said, I'll tell you what I need, though. We need quite a bit of garden hose, you know, for some reason or another. I'm not too sure what that reason was either, mm-hmm. but he needed about 500 feet of garden hose.
Okay.
I said, okay, I'll trade you garden hose for sand, for two pallets of sandbags. He said, and I need them trucked over there to Quaviet. He said, no problem. This Army engineers. They can fix our Jeeps, by the way, and we can take them by over. The test run, we would take the mechanic by the liquor store on the base,
mm-hmm.
and he would be paid pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd take him back. And, we'd trade a couple of fists of good whiskey, and they could overhaul a Jeep. Mm-hmm. No problem at all. Coffee grounds were good trading material.
Mm-hmm.
They're always good.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, I didn't have 500 feet of garden hose. Not even close. I didn't even have a garden hose.
But you told him that you did.
You bet. So he shipped me the sandbags. I took one pallet of the sandbags and traded them to a Army signal battalion who just happened to have a lot of garden hose. And then took it back, gave it to the Army engineers about a week later, and everything just fine.
Why was it so easy to do this barter system?
You were Americans,
mm-hmm.
and you were in a foreign country,
mm-hmm.
and the Saigon warriors could get anything they wanted. Everything mm-hmm. came in at Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
Something like a simple American soft drink.
Mm-hmm.
There were no Coca-Colas at Quaviet. Da Nang, you might see some.
Mm-hmm.
By the time the supply train, so to speak, got to Quaviet, you were looking at probably a cheap brand of Sprite or a grocery store brand of some cola.
Mm-hmm.
But you could go out at the fishing village right outside the gate,
mm-hmm.
pay somebody $10 American money, and buy a case of Coca-Colas. I never did, but I know people that did.
That's interesting.
If you ordered beer, we got Slitz and Falstaff. Saigon and everybody else was getting the good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the whiskey was just about the same shape.
Really? Mm.
Farther north you got, the more scarce it got.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Sounds like it.
But anyway, well... I also found out that I could go in any shop
mm-hmm.
in any Army base and just act like I knew what I was doing. I could walk off with whatever we needed half the time.
How would you have to act?
Huh?
What would you say? What do you mean you have to act like you knew what you were doing? What would you tell
them? Act like you knew what you were doing. Just go in and tell this fellow, say, I need to pick up such and such, take it over to... Tell him where we was taking it to, and he said, sure, go ahead. Say, you need some help loading it. And my team, there was four of mm-hmm. them, and they were really good at this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So supplies, we didn't have a We didn't have a washing machine, didn't have a dryer. When we first got there, we had no running water to the commodes in the bathroom in our building. What you did, if you had time before you had to use the commode, you went, took a bucket and went down the river, got a bucket of water and brought it back. Of course, you pour it in, it's going to flush. If you didn't have time, after you got through, you'd go to take your bucket and get a bucket of water and bring it back. Okay, by the time we got through, we had a water buffalo, which is a water trailer on wheels. We wound up with that somehow or another. Traded some things for it, I think. I'm not sure, but I think we did. And we brought it back because the Vietnamese had the key to the water pump on the base. And they would only let us have 1 hour of potable water at lunchtime and 1 hour at supper time, and that was it. And that was if the man that had the key was on the base. And that was our extent of our potable water on the base. Okay, what we would do, we got some Seabees. Navy Seabees came in. They decided they, the Vietnamese, they was going to build them up here so they could tie the boats up to it. We got them to take their crane, their welder, took all the wheels off this water trailer, took a crane, set it up on top of the building above the bathroom, and we had running water because we piped it in from the pipe coming from the water pump. And we had it going up there, and every time we knew that water was on, we had water running. We'd fill that water buffalo. We had running water for our kitchen sink, everything.
Pretty ingenious.
You had to be to survive in that particular outfit.
Tell me about the monsoons. You get some pictures of before and after the monsoons. What was that like?
Well, the monsoon season, you have the dry season in the summer. No rain whatsoever. The river gets really low. In some places as low as 6 foot deep, and some of those boats were probably close to 5 foot draft, four foot draft anyway, maybe five on some of them. And it was hot. I'm sure it was close to probably in the 120 bracket or thereabouts in the daytime, it felt like it, and probably in the 90s at night. Just guessing from what I can remember of it. It was cold during the monsoon season. We wore rain gear all the time. Navy foul weather jackets, which have a kind of a fur fleece lining in them. You'd have that, then you'd have raincoat on top of that, rain bridges, the whole works, because in you can imagine the hardest rain you've ever seen, and imagine it doing that for 52 or 3 days and nights straight with very little breaks. Then it was cloudy and no rain for about 3 days and nights. Sun actually came out a couple of times, then it rained for another month and a half, and then the monsoon season was over. The river during that season, we also had the monsoon. One monsoon, I don't know the name of it, came pretty close to the coast, which makes the tides, just like a hurricane, they do strange things. And the river rose to where the our building was, probably 50 feet, maybe from the water, or maybe a little long, farther than that. Well, the building was had 4 foot of water in it at one point. So we had that move us back farther into the base, in another building there for a while. And it was just rainy, dreary, and you went on the river every day. And it would rain so hard that you couldn't even see up the river where they were going half the time. And be a river pilot in those circumstances with just a little hairy.
I can imagine.
a lot of apprehension then.
As an advisor, did you feel like the Vietnamese were capable of taking over the war and defending their country?
As a whole, I don't know. Because I don't think they had been around it so long. A lot of them didn't take it all that seriously, I don't think. The sailors didn't. And when they would go to general quarters, which is battle stations, that one night that a mortar came in and hit right in the middle of the base, over by the helicopter pad, as a matter of fact, we were all in spread out in three different bunkers. And the Vietnamese were all on the inside of the perimeter. Now, this base on two sides, and the side where the road comes in has minefields with landmines, claymores, I guess, some type of landmines anyway. And then you have the river on the other, on the front side. And the Vietnamese, some of them, when they would come to battle stations, they would bring a blanket and a cot with them. And several of them would lay down and go to sleep. And you'd have one over here and one way over there standing guard.
And that's all?
Yeah. And all of us, we were wide awake, had flak jackets on, helmets, the weapons, the whole work. We were ready for bear. And the Vietnamese taking a nap out there. So I don't think they took it that seriously. Overall, I don't know whether they were ready or not. That particular bunch that we were advisory to, advisory team to, I don't think they were.
Okay.
And I saw that attitude several times. We had one instance where we had a new kid come on board, American. Green, right out of boot camp, I think. He hadn't been in the Navy hardly any time at all, and he's young. And the first thing we did after we break him in, we go on patrol with him, send him with somebody else on patrol a couple of times. He's going to be a radio operator, riding patrol boats. And he goes, first night we send him out by himself with the Vietnamese on the boat.
The first night.
This is after he's rode several trial runs with another advisor.
Okay.
The Vietnamese go down to where there's this particular checkpoint was, which was right before you get to the fork of the river. It's one of the checkpoints where we always kept a patrol boat in that area. And they run this Mike 6 up to the beach. They put it in forward gear. They lower the ramp, and the Vietnamese, every one of them, bailed off the boat out there in the middle of the night and went off wandering around and left that kid on there.
Oh, boy.
And all we could hear was screaming over that radio.
What was he saying?
You couldn't make it out other than they've left me and they'd come get me. He was just about right there. Well, we didn't have a boat. We can't just go out and jump on a boat because they all belong to the Vietnamese. Wake up the senior advisor. He goes over and talks to the base commander. This is at 3 o'clock in the morning, 2 o'clock in the morning maybe. Base commander has to get a boat crew together. So they get a boat crew finally. And then this takes about an hour to do all this through lines of communications. They finally get a boat crew, me and another advisor, me and two other ones went on this trip, and we go to rescue this kid. Well, we get up there, and he's still up there by himself, the Vietnamese. We can see them just fixing to come on the boat. And this kid, he's about to shoot everything that moves with that M16, if he really knows how to use it. And we he just broke. I had a nervous breakdown just about over that deal. We brought him back. We finally calmed him down, got him on the other boat, took him back to the base. Next day, we took him to Da Nang, and I think headquarters might have done something else with him.
Hmm.
But he wasn't ready for that.
Hmm.
And that's how seriously they would, the Vietnamese took some of this stuff.
Right.
In the outfit I was in.
It's a good example.
I can't say that all of them are like that. Mm-hmm. Because I don't know. But we did have some goofballs just like the Americans did.
Right. How did you deal personally with the idea or the thought that you could be killed anytime?
It's a lot differently than if someone was out in the woods shooting at me, and I can shoot back.
Mm-hmm.
A mine is a whole different feeling, because you don't know if there's one, and if there's one, you don't know if it's going to go off under your boat or not, or your boat's going to hit it. And you're pretty apprehensive about that. You always think about it.
Mm-hmm.
It got a lot easier as the trips went along.
Mm-hmm.
But I was always a little leery of it. I was scared a lot of times. I can't say I wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
But of course you have to try to do your job. And I think that if I would have really broken down on a river, so to speak, after a mine or during a mine sweep adventure. Vietnamese, I don't think they would have thought much of me, really. I don't think they would have. They'd have been like, I always thought they might be like bunch of little kids. You'd never hear the end of it. I worried about it. I was scared. I'd come back in. I guess, I did drink. And I would come in, have a cold beer, and I'd sit and relax a little while, and I'd have supper. And I might have two or three more before I went to bed, and I might not, depending on what I had to do. Because I always had to get together with the senior advisor and find out. He tried to keep me as informed, just about as informed as he was, which
this
was
the
good.
Vietnamese, right?
No, this was the American.
This is the American. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
My senior advisor.
Yours. Okay.
And so I'd get together with him every morning and every evening, and for any additional instructions or what might be going on that he's found out or this, that, or other. So I really didn't have that much time to play around. That kid, he liked lost it. I don't think they took it seriously, a lot of them, the Vietnamese sailors. They were born in the thing. The French were fighting them before. Or they were fighting the French, rather. I just don't think they took it seriously.
What did they think of... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
What did they think of Americans, of you guys there?
Well, that's hard to say. Several of them I considered pretty good friends by the time that tour was over. We had one boat crew that would not speak English whatsoever, and they were liable not to say too much Vietnamese to you. It was kind of like you were in the way, so to speak. One boat crew did act like that. The rest of them were fairly friendly. If you had cigarettes, some of you, they were extra friendly.
Right.
And, or sea rations, they were extra friendly also. And I can't speak for exactly what they did really think of us. I think some of them were glad we were there to help. And I imagine some of them just wish we'd disappear. Mm-hmm. Just depended.
Did they ask you a lot of questions about the United States and what it was
sure.
like in America?
They asked about where I was from and the area that I'd been brought up in. And of course, I asked countless questions about them. I've been one that every overseas country or every island in the Caribbean I've been to, I was curious. I want to know this, that, and other. I want to go in the cafe and eat their food. Mm-hmm. I never did know a lot of Americans go to a foreign country and if they can't have steak and potatoes, they're just unhappy with the whole atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And they want it to be another United States, and it's not.
Mm-hmm.
So I ate Vietnamese food. I tried to learn the language. I could speak it pretty good there for a while, but I lost it when I came back.
Mm-hmm.
Just by not using it.
Do you remember any Vietnamese?
About the closest thing I could come to, and the accent is not going to be right.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have a weird accent. I cannot get their sing-song mm-hmm. deal down. But it had something to do with Toy de Vietnam Mm-hmm. Which, if any kind of luck, that should have read, I was over there 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
I was on Hai Quan from sea, something or another, was a Navy advisor, some or another.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't remember that much of it anymore.
Okay.
What if a VO was, of course, a roadway or waterway or something.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember a lot of it.
Okay. What did you think of overall United States policy toward Vietnam? You were there in the later stages of the
I was out there in the later stage. I was a Navy recruiter during the bad part.
Right, right.
Here in Lubbock.
Mm-hmm.
And Lubbock, I have to give the people here a lot of credit because I didn't see here what I saw on the national news
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
in places out in California and different places like that. I did not see that here.
Talking about the anti-war movement?
Right.
Okay.
I didn't see that.
Mm-hmm.
I had a lot of kids come in and ask me, will I have to go to Vietnam? And we had the draft,
mm-hmm.
which was a good incentive to join the Navy or some other service if mm-hmm. you so desired. And I would tell them I hadn't been yet. I went after I got my orders to Vietnam while I was on recruiting duty
in
about 8 months before the end of my tour.
Right.
And I could truthfully tell, I always try to tell the truth if I could.
Mm-hmm.
I'd tell them they wouldn't like boot camp. They was going to take a lot of tests and they better do the best they can on them because otherwise they wasn't going to get a very good job at Navy.
Mm-hmm.
And then the needs of the Navy and what the... Sometimes you don't get what you want, even though you get three choices.
Mm-hmm.
And needs the Navy come first. And I tried to tell them all that. Well, mostly to keep them, the parents, from coming in the office mad at us, because that's really bad publicity then.
Yes.
And for the recruiting service.
Mm-hmm.
And these kids would come in, will I have to go to Vietnam? I said, well, I don't know. I can't tell you that. I can tell you that I've been in the Navy so many years and I have not gone yet, mm-hmm. but I expect a set of orders, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if that's in me or not.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I used to tell them.
Mm-hmm.
And, most time it worked.
Did you think that the United States efforts to secure South Vietnam as a democratic country was viable, that it would work?
I think it could have if they would have let the Americans do the jobs they're trained for.
Okay.
We had restrictions. As an example, on the Quaviet River,
mm-hmm.
in order to fire for an American advisor to fire a weapon on the Quaviet River.
Like your M16?
Right. I could not fire unless I was being fired upon. And then before, if you went about it the legal way, mm-hmm. which I'll tell you how we got around it, say you caught somebody on a patrol boat at night, or right about dusk, and it's off past curfew a little bit, and they're still out there wandering around up down the riverbank, you don't know how many is out there. You could, the only place we could hit a free fire zone was the river basin at the river mouth.
Okay.
Past that was probably a quarter of a mile.
Mm-hmm.
Anywhere inland, we'd get permission to fire. In order to get permission to fire, you were supposed to contact your senior advisor, who would contact the commander of the, his counterpart was the commander of the Navy, Vietnamese Navy base. That was his counterpart. Who would contact every village chief, mayor, or whatever you want to call them, they call them village chiefs, the province chief, and everybody in that whole area before you could shoot anything. Now, the Vietnamese didn't go by that. The Vietnamese sailors, they saw somebody, they could fire just like that.
How'd you get around this?
Usually fire when the Vietnamese did, because, and if they really wanted to fire at somebody that they just swore up down, that they just needed to shoot at, the Vietnamese sailors on the boat.
Mm-hmm.
They would have somebody in the bow of the boat fire an M16 in automatic. And somebody in the back of the boat would key the microphone on the radio. And they would say something to the effect that we are taking incoming, may we fire back? And they would give permission just like that.
And then they would do their business.
And they'd go ahead and take care of it and go on down the river.
Did you ever fire your weapon?
Yes.
What was that incident like? Or incidents?
Well, it, we could barely see the flash from across the river. It was a sniper shooting across the river. You couldn't see anybody. And we did fire back in that direction several times. I could not see anyone that's other than just target practice or something like that. I never fired a weapon over there. Carried them all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Never had fire one, except that one time. And then I wasn't really too sure what hit anybody or not anyway, because mm-hmm. couldn't see them.
Right. Were you firing your M16?
Yes.
So how did you feel when you got your orders, or you knew you were leaving? How did you feel?
Well, I felt kind of apprehensive. I use that word a lot on this tour.
Mm-hmm.
When I got my orders, I got a verbal confirmation first
mm-hmm.
from the chief recruiter in our headquarters in Albuquerque. And he called me up and said, "Petty Officer Clayton, have you ever been to Vietnam?" And I said, "Well, no, Chief, I haven't." I said, he said, "Would you like to go?" And I said, "Well, I guess to go over on the ship or something might not be too bad." And he started laughing. And then he started reading my orders, and he said, "Guess what?" And he said, "I'll go ahead and send them to you, forward them to you in the mail. You should get them next day or two." This was 8 months before my tour was up here.
Mm-hmm. Now, how did you feel leaving Vietnam when you were there in Vietnam and got to getting ready to go home?
Leaving, I was actually really happy to come back.
Mm-hmm.
And I was coming to a tour of duty that I had a good sense of. I'm kind of proud that I did my best, what I thought was my best at my job. In this particular deal, we got to show them a couple of things that were new.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, they didn't use them, but I got to show it to them anyway. And once the Vietnamese sailors decided one way worked, well, that was it.
He stuck with that.
But I was really happy to get back and go to Charleston. I had an opportunity to take the chief's test for E7 pay grade. while I was on leave.
Mm-hmm.
I had 42 days to get to Charleston County, 30-day leave, travel pay, and delay, and reporting, and everything else that they tack on there. But I had to be in Charleston in 11 days in order to take the test.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I got there and took the test, passed it, and made it. So I was really happy to, because I knew I could take that test then. Mm-hmm. I couldn't take it. I was eligible in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't let me off the river to go to Da Nang and take the test.
Okay.
First time I was eligible.
Okay. What was the flight back like?
Everybody was pretty happy on it.
Did you leave out of Tonsonut down in Saigon, or did you fly out of Da Nang?
No, we left out of Da Nang. How you doing, Dr. Rector?
Okay, go ahead, sir. So the flight home, you said, was extremely happy.
Yeah, everybody was in pretty good mood all the way back.
Mm-hmm.
We stopped in Honolulu International Airport about midnight one night to refuel.
Mm-hmm.
They let us off the plane for about 45 minutes, and of course, there wasn't anything open much in the airports. And we got back on the plane, and then we flew into Norton Air Force Base, California.
Mm-hmm.
Which I guess it must be about 30, 40 miles out of Los Angeles.
Okay,
we had to go through customs. There were only 10 sailors on the plane.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Most of it was Air Force and Army, mostly Air Force on that particular plane, a few Marines. The Air Force went through customs first, since it was an Air Force base.
Okay.
And we had to catch a cab to the airport in Los Angeles.
Now, were you in uniform?
I was in dress blues.
Okay.
We had to come back in dress uniform.
Okay.
And so I came back in my dress blues. Then went through customs. Went to L.A. International. That picture book, I figured they'd confiscate it right off the bat. We were told not to take any pictures and bring them back.
Mm-hmm.
And the customs in Da Nang and the customs at Northern Air Force Base, they looked at it, didn't even open it, just kept going. Cause all I had was a small duffel bag. Didn't have a whole lot that I brought back. But I turned in all my military weapons and the helmets and all that sort of stuff before I left.
Did you have any problems at LAX?
No, no problem
at all. Nobody gave any problems?
Got there just in time to get on my plane, and it stopped 10 minutes in El Paso just to take on or let off some people and then right to Lubbock.
Okay. And how did your family react when you got here back in Lubbock?
They was pretty happy. They didn't. I didn't know exactly when I was coming in. I told them when I wrote. I gave them a time frame, but I gave them about four different days there. And I got here the day before the first day I thought I was going to be here.
Okay.
We left a day early because there was another typhoon coming in over there in Da Nang area. So we left the day. They put us on the plane day early. So I got Lubbock Airport. Nobody knew I was here. So I called the house. And first wife wasn't home. So I called O'Donnell from the airport. Told him I was in. By the time that I got a hold of the first wife, everybody had met me at the airport. A pretty happy reunion.
Yeah.
And she had already got her mobile home pretty well packed and ready to go back to the East Coast. So we stayed about 5 days and then had to go out there so I could take that test.
Did you have any difficulty transitioning back to the United States from Vietnam?
I don't think I did, really. I don't think I had any problem at all. Get right down to it. It was a little strange there for 2 or 3 days. Nothing spectacular.
Did people ask you a lot of questions about your Vietnam tour?
Yes.
Yeah.
They asked, and they acted like they were pretty interested in And so I told them a little bit about what I did. Like I say, the people in this area were, I think, I've heard some terrible stories from people I know that were over there that say these things, terrible things happened to them when they came back to the States and never saw it.
That's good.
I was really lucky, I guess. And but I've heard of people just, you know, throwing eggs and spitting on custom and everything else, and I never saw none of it.
Good.
None of it ever happened, as far as I was concerned.
How did you feel when the United States left Vietnam in 1973? Do you think it was the right thing to be done?
At the time, I didn't think that we were over there, but we were so restricted, I thought, in what we would buy, government or whoever or whatever entity was restricting us from doing the job. I can see one reason possibly why not, because if we would have invaded North Vietnam, then we would have had to deal with China, and it would have been the domino effect, I think, and we could have been in a real mess. On the other hand, I think we were better. We were just as well off to go ahead. To me, it looked like everybody just said, okay, that's it. This is the end. Let's all go home. We all won. That's what it looked like.
How'd you feel, Dan?
And then I felt kind of sad because the government that we were trying to keep in place for so long was no longer going to be, or was no longer, and it had reverted back to the government from Hanoi and the North Vietnamese government. I just didn't feel right about that.
This is April 1975.
Yes.
Fall of Saigon. And didn't hit well. I
watched a lot of it on the news and everything, television news, and it brought back a lot of memories of where I was at, and I could picture people. I could actually picture some of the Vietnamese sailors, and some of the advisory unit. I wondered whatever might have happened to some of them then, because I'm sure that it all had to revert back to the North Vietnamese way of dealing things. And I didn't know whether the South Vietnamese, the Viet Cong, so to speak, would be, or the South Vietnamese would be fighting anymore, or if they would just, it comes under, I thought a lot of them would come under the deal about the battle quarters on the base, where life goes on, so to speak.
Okay.
And so I finally came up with that conclusion on it.
Okay.
I don't have any bad feelings. I think our government and our heads of state did the best they could with what they knew about the thing. I think they, in certain ways, they could have done a little bit better. And like I said, we might be in World War III if we'd have kept advancing, if they had actually let us do what we're trained to do. And with armed forces is to, main job is to, if you're not keeping peace, you're fighting and shooting people to preserve some way of life, and or killing them or imprisoning them or whatever. And that's what armed forces do. You just have these fancy jobs to keep you occupied to help you do this.
What do you think about the United States' role in the world, trying to do things like they did in Vietnam, basically helping, encouraging democratic countries and being involved militarily in these type of operations?
I think that we need to expand a defense budget quite a bit, because look at our Navy. how we used to have over 1,000 ships in the U.S. and United States Navy at one time. That was during President Carter's tour. Well, right at 400 now. And you just, I think it's hard to spread out people and restrict them in their jobs in a whole lot of countries without getting more manpower, more ships, more planes, expand the military forces, and you cannot do that without money.
Right.
You have to have the budget increased. If they don't, we have a volunteer force. I'm sure sometimes it's hard for the recruiters to get somebody to make their recruiting quota, so to speak, for the month, or however they do it nowadays. Because they know, if they've got any sense at all, the kids are going to know once I get in the service, there's a good chance that I'm not going to be in the United States for a while when I leave.
Right.
And I'm going to be gone for a longer period of time than years ago, probably. If they know anything about it at all, they're going to know this. If they've had people like me telling our stories, then they will know.
Right.
Like the dad was in World War II, the granddad, as the case is nowadays. And they left for 4 years.
Right.
And it could get back to that point in, where you're just gone in some other country forever.
What do you think about Vietnam today?
Vietnam, I don't hold. I'm not one of them that's still fighting the war.
Okay.
I do know that in the long run, in most cases, we go in, we try to do the right thing to get the right form of government, the right person in the head of state or whatever. And I know that after that you do certain things with bullets and bombs, then you have to, our country, we put money and people and we try to build them back up again. I do know that. And I do know that we're doing a lot of, there's a lot of trade areas opening in Vietnam now for private trade with the United States. And I have nothing against that, really.
Okay.
Maybe they will buy, for just an example, maybe they will have cotton mills set up over there by Americans or some Russians or some other country that has them. China has a lot of them. Maybe they will have cotton mills. They will buy United States cotton, which will help ease the surplus, which will bring the price up to where it should be, where we won't have to have a government safety net in order to just make expenses. So just for an example, I'd use that because I'm involved in the cotton industry.
Right. It makes a lot of sense. Would you ever want to go back to Vietnam?
Now I still have no desire really to go anywhere in any foreign country because two reasons. It's expensive to go overseas, and the attitude of certain parties, I think it's a little more dangerous being American overseas in certain countries.
Yes, I would agree with that.
And I'm not near as, I guess, brave or as gung-ho as I used to be. I'm older. I've developed a little sense now. And I have no desire to go overseas. I haven't had since I got out of the service. That's why I got out of the service. I was tired of being gone. And I had 1 year, 14-month period I set my foot on the soil in Norfolk, Virginia one day. I was gone 9 months. We came back for 4 days. I had duty on the ship 3 of those days. The Thursday we came in, and the Saturday and Sunday. I got off Friday night after work. Went home to my family. Went back Saturday morning, had duty. That's guard duty, fire party, you name it, and do the weekend work that needs done. Monday, we left for the Caribbean. And we were gone for, that was during the Dominican Republic deal in 65.
Mm-hmm.
So we were down there patrolling back and forth down the Caribbean for 4 months.
Mm-hmm.
My last year in the Navy, I spent 10 months of it at sea on ammunition, at a supply ship. I was tired.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. Have you had any contact with Vietnamese Americans, Vietnamese living here in America?
There used to be a lady that I talked to every once in a while, worked at the BX, mm-hmm. the store out at Reese Air Force Base.
Mm-hmm.
And when I go through the line, well, we would talk a little bit while I was checking out, and that was about it. I don't know any other Vietnamese or mother come this.
Okay.
I know there are quite a few of them here. I just haven't met any of them.
Do you read books on the Vietnam War?
No, I don't.
Okay. Have you seen any movies on the Vietnam War?
Well, I saw one. What was it? The Green Beret.
The Green Berets?
Mm-hmm. I saw that one.
Mm-hmm. John Wayne?
Yeah, with the Greyhound Trailways bus going across that one scene.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
I've watched, I like service movies. I especially like Navy movies, mm-hmm. or old movies, or new ones.
Mm-hmm.
And I've watched Saving Private Ryan. I went to the theater and watched that one. That, mm-hmm. that was some really good acting in that one.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And, but normally, if I watch movies or anything, I go for the comedies.
Okay.
Even on television.
Uh-huh.
I watch the news religiously every night and usually every morning.
Mm-hmm.
I try to keep up with things current as they tell them to us on the overseas, Iraq, and this, mm-hmm. this, that, that.
Mm-hmm.
I keep up with it pretty much on the news and the papers.
Okay. Okay. Are there any songs that take you back to Vietnam, your Vietnam time?
No.
No?
I never did know any of them. There were a lot of them written by a fellow here in Lubbock, I understand. I heard him sing a few of them over to BFW one time. But I never did hear any of them over there.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time when I listened to the radio there was Vietnamese music.
Right.
We had a Vietnamese USO show came up there
for
Christmas.
Uh-huh.
And but it was actually a Filipino USO show.
Right.
Came up there, and they sang everything in Spanish.
A Filipino USO show in Spanish?
Yeah. And then they had the Vietnamese, had a bunch of little Vietnamese kids got up there and sang some couple of Christmas songs in Vietnamese songs, I guess. I guess it was Christmas songs,
mm-hmm.
in Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
That was it. And, but I've listened to a lot of Vietnamese radio stations.
Mm-hmm. Do you miss that music at all?
I don't miss it. It was interesting to listen to.
Mm-hmm.
It was different.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've been around music all my life.
Right.
Took 8 years piano lessons, played guitar since I was 10, been mm-hmm. in several Western dance bands when I was younger.
Mm-hmm.
And so I notice music. We go dancing a lot, and this, that, and other.
Good. What do you think of your service in Vietnam today when you look back at that year you spent there?
I'm proud of my service that I spent there in Vietnam. I wish we could have done more. But I'm proud of the service that I gave them.
Okay. What was the most significant thing you learned while in Vietnam?
Patience. Patience with the Vietnamese.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
And I learned a lot of leadership qualities that I didn't really possess all that well.
Mm-hmm.
I learned quite a bit. Mm-hmm. I had that bunch that in the outfit was something else. We had a lot of good times, really.
Yeah.
And I'm proud. I'm proud of my service. I'm glad that I went over there. And I probably would have extended, but I had this really good set of orders to go back to a river mine sweeper.
Mm-hmm.
In Charleston.
Mm-hmm.
And but I was proud of it.
Okay. Today, if you had to tell young Americans about the Vietnam War and about Vietnam, what would you tell them?
The same thing I'm telling you.
Okay. Okay.
And I'd probably stretch it a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
I probably remember by then. I probably remember if it came up pretty recently.
Mm-hmm.
I'd probably think of a few more things I haven't told you that I haven't thought about.
Do you think the United States learned any lessons from the Vietnam War?
I would hope that we have. But when we send our people into other countries that are not actually fighting with another country, they're fighting within.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder. But I hope we learn something out of it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure we learned that the people in Vietnam, the North Vietnamese, do not give up very easily.
Mm-hmm.
And, like I say, I hope we learned some. Sometime I doubt it when I see the news, but I hope we did.
Would you classify the Vietnam War as a loss or stalemate or a victory for the United States?
I think it was a stalemate and a loss.
Okay.
We lost over 55,000 military people over there. That was the loss.
Yes.
We spent a lot of money losing those people. Another loss. I think they just had to work out some kind of a treaty that appeased all the parties involved.
Mm-hmm.
All of us could declare ourselves winners and go home. I think we just got tired, really, and saw that we weren't getting anywhere. With the way that we were fighting this thing, and they didn't want to actually go to an all-out deal, I think. I don't think they really wanted to do that. Like I say, it could have dominoed on us, I believe. We're always having words with China to start with, and China was a big backer, and probably still is, North Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
I know they were. North Vietnamese used a lot of Chinese weaponry.
Yes. So, is there anything else that you'd like to add to the interview or any other information?
I got about, I can be real brief with the rest of my time in the service, I guess.
Go right ahead, sir.
And, because it's barely lunchtime anyway. Anyway, I went to Charleston.
Mm-hmm.
And I went, they put me on a mine layer, mine recovery vessel.
Mm-hmm.
For a year. Then I went on minesweep boat number 7, MSB-7, which I had been on when I was a deckhand.
Earlier, right,
seaman,
right.
Years before.
Right.
We took all the minesweep gear off of it, the 13 boat, put a tow rig on it. And we helped train the helicopter pilots in HM-12. They were starting to learn how to have helicopters tow miniature minesweeping gear. similar. It's the same thing they used in Hanoi Harbor to clear it after all this mess was over. Mm-hmm. And we have trained the pilots on the East Coast. Okay. Did that for 3 years.
Okay.
We would tow the gear under the bridge, Grace Memorial Bridge, Cooper River Bridge, mm-hmm. out in the harbor. The Hilo would come by. He'd drop this huge hook on a cable about a 2-inch diameter mm-hmm. down. The tow wire had a big ball that had a flat side on, mm-hmm. on the back of it mm-hmm. that was affixed to the end of the wire. Okay, we had it. He would drop the hook, pick up the wire at some point between us and the sweep gear. We would hit a quick release hook called Pelican hook and turn it loose. Then he would get his winch, pull the tow wire up to the inside of the back of the helicopter, hook mm-hmm. it up, and they would start back and forth through the minefield. Hmm. He only had actually not hardly any danger at all to anybody. He had a crew of 5 in a helicopter 70 feet above the water.
Mm-hmm. Much safer.
And they'd fly around, tow it all day, bring it back to us. We'd recover it, mm-hmm. take it into the pier. They'd bring it up on the pier because it's pretty big equipment. Mm-hmm. And we did that, us in the 13 boat, for 3 years.
Okay. Was that more effective minesweeping, in your opinion, than what you had done before?
I think it...
Before you were on the river, on the water.
Yeah.
And now you're above.
Well, on the water, I think there's more danger. Mm-hmm. But I think I always thought the effectiveness, we had more to work with on the boats. Mm-hmm. The helicopter didn't have a whole lot of room to store all these different types of gear.
Right.
Couldn't store any of it, really.
Right.
And so they had to have a tender boat, so to speak, or escort or whatever, to get this equipment mm-hmm. out in the water so mm-hmm. they could pick it up and use it. Mm-hmm. I think they did really well once they learned how to use it. And it miniaturized some of it.
Okay.
We still got the old ways. The chain bottom drag is a wire hooked together between two ships or two boats running up the river. Got the contact mine, a wire down to the cement anchor. It's below the surface usually where you can't see it. This wire hooks onto it. Then when it finally pops up to the surface, then a boat behind shoots it or something that detonates it on the contact mines. Mm-hmm. A helicopter, it's just hard to do that.
Right.
Anyway, after that, I went to an ammunition ship. Ammunition supply ship, USS Santa Barbara, E-28, out of Goose Creek Naval Weapons Station, mm-hmm. Charleston. Mm-hmm. Spent a year on that. Mm-hmm. On that, all we did was refuel and arm carriers and destroyers, and then we'd take the bullets off of them and this, that, and there. Well, after that, I was a tugboat operator for 4 years, I'm sorry. In Norfolk Navy Station, and I hauled ammunition and fuel barges to Yorktown up the York River.
Mm, okay.
I came alongside the ship. Mm-hmm. So ran a 109-foot tug for 4 years.
This then, is after Charleston?
After Charleston. Okay. This was in Norfolk Navy Station.
Okay.
Then I went to the USS Santa Barbara back in Charleston again.
Okay.
And spent my remaining time in the Navy on it.
And this is 79?
79 and up till March of 80.
Okay. And why'd you decide to get out of the Navy?
I was just tired of traveling. Mm-hmm. And I think the duty might have had a lot to do with it. Santa Barbara, I'd been on small boats and minesweepers and tugboats. Mm-hmm. And first big ship I was really attached to is ship's company, mm-hmm. not as... down in the troop compartment, so to speak. And I didn't really know my job that well, like I was expected to. Mm-hmm. I was head of 2nd Division for 3 months, and I finally requested a transfer. I knew I was fixing to get busted or something, because I just flat didn't know what I was doing. Those rigs, transfer rigs on that ship, weren't even in the book that I had for going up for rate. Mm-hmm. never seen them before. Mm-hmm. And so I wound up on assistant chief master at arms, and I worked the rest of the time on the ship as master at arms, catching them with the dope or whatever else they might be doing wrong on there, taking them captain's mess and having to maintain order on the ship. Mm-hmm. That's what I did until about a month before, about the 1st of March of 1980, I still had a month to do.
This is your 20-year mark.
Yeah, on the 20-year mark.
Right.
So they transferred me. The ship was going overseas again. We just got back overseas, and it's going overseas again. And if you had less than 30 days, you didn't have to go with the ship before you ended your tour. Mm-hmm. And I had 28 days or something like that. Mm-hmm. It was about the 3rd or 4th of March, I guess, 1980. So they transferred me to a barracks there in South Carolina, and I stayed there for the rest of the month.
Okay.
Then go with my dad and took my retirement.
And did you move back to Lubbock at that time?
No. I worked in Cross, South Carolina, Monk's Corner area, northwest of Charleston. Mm-hmm. For Santee Cooper Electric, running a work boat, maintaining navigation aids in the in Lake Moultrie, Lake Marion, and in the Santee River, for the Cooper River. And then I did that for a year, and then I went to Pickens, South Carolina, where the first wife was from, and I worked in a cotton mill for 2 years, nearly 3 years. Oh, about 2 years, I guess, before I came to Lubbock.
Okay. Been here ever since.
Yeah, I just settled here in Lubbock. Came back to see my father. My mother had died in 71, 72, April 72, car wreck. But I came back to see Dad, and I'm just familiar with this area. My first wife died. And so I just sold everything, came out here, settled here in Lubbock.
So you took a long route from O'Donnell around the world.
Around the world.
Back here to West Texas.
Around the world several times, it seemed like. 5 years in the Caribbean, 3 months at a 4 months at a time, and 3 years in the Mediterranean, 6, 7, 8, and 9 months at a time.
Mm-hmm.
Plus up down the East Coast, had years South Vietnam, California twice.
Mm-hmm. Where's the most interesting place you traveled to?
Most interesting place I traveled to, I would say, would be in Italy and Sicily, mostly Italy.
Mm-hmm.
Italy and Spain.
Mm-hmm.
Italy because Mount Vesuvius, I've been to the top of it, read about it in history books.
Mm-hmm. And you could actually be there.
And I've been there.
Right.
I've seen the ancient city of Pompeii ruins where they're digging them up.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen the factory there in Naples. I went through it where they... The cameo jewelry is handmade from seashells there.
Hmm.
And I bought some cameo jewelry for different people there. And,
does your Vietnam experience seem like just a small dot on a long journey along that?
It does.
Doesn't really stand out as a big
thing? It stands out as it being the most important part of my Navy career.
Okay.
I can put it that way because we were... sweeping live mines, we were actually doing what I'd been training to do all those years.
Right, right.
You know, so that it was really the most important phase of my career in Navy.
Okay.
I could say that.
Okay. Well, is there anything else you'd like to add or say?
I guess that's just about it. I'm getting a little hungry. How about you?
Yes, sir. All right. Well, this will end our interview with Sumner Clayton. Thank you very much, sir.
All right.